Today's episode of Hidden Forces is made possible by listeners like you. For more information about this week's episode or for easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page. And remember, if you listen to the show on your Apple Podcast app, you can give us a review. Each review helps more people find the show and join our amazing community. And with that, please enjoy this week's episode. What's up, everybody? I'm Dimitri Kafinas, and you're listening to Hidden Forces, where each week I speak with experts in the fields of technology, science, finance, and culture to help you gain the tools to better navigate an increasingly complex world so that you're less surprised by tomorrow and better able to predict what happens next. My guest this week is Peter Buchbar, Chief Investment Officer for Bleakley Advisory Group and a regular on CNBC, where he provides market commentary about Fed policy, market trends, economic data, stocks, bonds, you name it. Every now and again, I like to bring people from the media onto this program to get their take on the market and to hear what their colleagues are thinking about the latest economic data, news, and information and how it's impacting the narratives being constructed by the press to explain what we're seeing and what we can expect to see in the coming weeks and months. I've noticed a significant shift in how the media has been talking about markets recently, even the words that they've been using to describe developments that, in a different time and place, would have elicited positive commentary, are being characterized today in bearish terms. I asked Peter for his interpretation of some of the recent economic data, including the latest manufacturing numbers out of Germany, as well as the recent anecdotal data provided by Apple in their 1,400-word letter to investors that led to a 10% drop in their stock price, their worst one-day performance in 5 years. We discuss recent comments by Fed Chairman Powell, the prospect and performance of financial stocks, concerns about liquidity, the government shutdown, trade, China, marijuana stocks, electric vehicles, and what I believe is the resurgence of democratic socialism as a powerful force that markets will need to contend with in 2020. And with that, let's get right in to this week's episode. Peter Buchbar, welcome to Hidden Forces.
Great to be here. Thanks.
It's great having you on the program. I was telling you before we started what I'm most interested in. The reason that I asked you to come on the program is that not just because you have an understanding of financial markets, but you're such a regular commentator and you're present in financial media. And I'm really interested in how the narrative has, I think, shifted in financial media and how investors are looking at the market today. I told you, with no material impact or difference in objective reality, you would, I think, differ with that a little bit. I'm curious what you have to say. How is the media and how are investors looking at the market in 2019?
Well, let's take a step back because I think we have to look at the steps that led into 2018 and thus 2019 to have perspective on that. So you talk about the financial media. Look at 2017, okay? Come off the election, we had an extraordinarily low level of volatility. In fact, volatility for the last, call it, since probably 2010 has been very muted, helped out by central banks. So 2018 actually gave us a bout of volatility that people just weren't used to. And especially after what we saw in 2017. So when you get short market moves, well, people start paying attention. And how do they pay attention? Well, they turn on the TV or they turn the radio on and they listen to what the news is. So you get big market moves, that's attention grabbing. What the ISM did doesn't make people turn the TV on. But when the Dow is moving 300, 400, 500, 600 points a day, well, that is attention grabbing and that becomes important to the financial media because it also, on the reverse, becomes important for the economy because financial markets and the economy are so intertwined. So we go into 2019, with very limited visibility on how this grand central bank experiment is going to play out on the reverse. Where does the Chinese economy go? And there are signs that the U.S. economy is beginning to slow. So we didn't have a hissy fit in the fourth quarter in the financial markets for no particular reason. There are legitimate reasons why we saw what we saw.
What were the ISM numbers in December?
Well, we saw the ISM number last week, the manufacturing number that was soft, and we saw the services number yesterday that was weak as well. We saw an NFIB Small Business Optimism Index today that fell to the lowest level since late 2016. It's the lowest level since late 2017, but some key components fell to the lowest level since November 2016, which was the month of the election.
The Germans also had some industrial numbers that came out today, right? German economy.
Yes. So the third quarter in Germany was a contraction. There was the belief that that was temporary because the European Parliament had some auto emissions rules that came into effect that delayed shipments. People assumed that we would get a fourth quarter bounce back. And so far, we have not. We saw a weaker than expected factory order number out of Germany. We saw industrial production today was weaker than expected, which comes on the heels of obvious softness in China, soft data in Hong Kong, soft export numbers in South Korea. This is a global slowdown that we're right now in the midst of.
Good numbers came out in December, though, right, for their labor market?
Well, the consumer, both in the U.S. and actually Germany, is actually holding in. The unemployment rate in Germany at 5% is the lowest since reunification. They reported retail sales also yesterday that came in better than expected. Mm-hmm. But the industrial side is what's particularly soft.
We should note today is actually the 8th today? We're going to release this in a week's time. So this is Tuesday, January 8th, just for the audience to know. You mentioned the return of volatility, which is an interesting thing I was thinking about. First of all, volatility is pretty much at its historical average right now, correct?
Correct. And at 20, yes.
Yeah, and you said that volatility has been pretty damp since 2010, especially since 2012. And we were living in this period that I think PIMCO had coined the phrase, Alarion maybe had coined it, the new normal. And I wonder, are we just moving from new normal back to normal?
Well, the new
and
normal.
And that's just freaking everyone out?
Well, the new normal was in terms of economic growth rates. So, yes, in terms of volatility, we're back to the long-term average, but that's not something that people are used to. And when you look at the suppression of volatility and the release of it, well, there really isn't a blueprint for what we're experiencing when you have negative interest rates and you have the explosion of central bank balance sheets. That's not something that we're used to or have any experience with. So a move in volatility from 10 to 20, when you've suppressed it as much as we have, you know, is still a rather big deal. And there's the assumption that you can go from extreme to normal without going to the other way, where the pendulum's swinging the other way first before you actually settle into normal.
Before we turn on the microphone, I told you another data point that stuck out to me was Chairman Powell's speech at the American Economic Association's annual meeting in Atlanta. He was on a panel, I think, with Yellen and Bernanke.
Yep.
And he made the most sort of generic vanilla remarks, in my view. But markets seem to really take some relief from that. His point was basically, yes, of course, we will take into account the effects of asset price declines in the stock market as a forward indicator. We will take it into account when we decide whether we're going to hike again next time. It seems to me that markets are exhibiting a higher level of anxiety than I would have expected around the continued rate rises and balance sheet contraction of the Fed. Besides just this existential angst, do they have any material reason in the data to be anxious about this?
Well, you have to understand that market psychology, many times, a bunch of children. If they don't get their candy when they want it, they throw a tantrum. And central banks have been giving out the most amount of candy for a long period of time. So that's the mentality that every time a central banker of importance speaks, every time there's a meeting, well, there's always a big response to that if there is even the slightest change of thought and words. And I think what we saw proves how influential central bankers have been in manipulating not just markets, but investor psychology, both up and down, and that we can have such drastic moves, whereas in the early October, Powell says we're a long way from neutral, and then he, a few months later, says we're close to neutral, and then at the December FOMC meeting says, you know, autopilot with respect to the balance sheet, and then he talks about it being flexible. It shows you that there's still this addiction to wanting that candy from central banks.
You know, the Fed has gone from being, I mean, they were an institution that didn't even talk about what rate they were targeting, to an institution that then said this is the rate they were targeting for decades. And now we're at a place where there's this thing of forward guidance, where they've been coddling markets so long, to your point. I wonder if forward guidance has actually ties the Fed's hands more, and in that sense, it's less worth the benefit. And it's something that I think went to a new level with Bernanke that it wasn't the case with Greenspan. I mean, with Greenspan, there was just like a general sort of confidence in the maestro, right? Those are different days.
Monetary policy has turned into a game of semantics, okay? So forward guidance is inconsistent with data dependency. Greenspan raised rates at a measured pace, but he did it at every single meeting, 8 times a year.
You're saying leading up to 2008.
So I'm saying that they try to manipulate markets not just with the actual rate moves and balance sheet adjustments, but with their words. And they think that their words can somehow influence behavior. I mean, it's such nonsense, all of this. But unfortunately, the problem is that you've inflated asset prices to such an extent that if you don't get that help from central banks to the same extent, well, then you're just going to have an adjustment.
Well, we had that period where bad news is good news for financial markets. Remember that? Where if markets looked at negative economic data or anything that could perceive as negative, because it would suggest the Fed was on it and they would just pump more liquidity. I forget what period that was. Maybe it was between 2008 and 2012.
It was that risk-off period. QE1 began all the way through the end of QE3.
So are investors, because this is also, again, this is a different world, because they're not just dealing now with the Fed's rate decisions, they're also dealing with the Fed's balance sheet decisions, right? How are investors differentiating between the Fed's balance sheet operations in terms of runoff and contracting the balance sheet and their interest rate targeting?
Well, the interest rate targeting is much more visible. It shows up not just with their announcements, but it shows up in the cost of capital. It influences the yield curve. It influences LIBOR, and we're in a world with a lot of floating rate debt. So there's a direct influence on what the Fed does with respect to interest rates. The balance sheet is sort of, I don't want to say a mystery, but it's a mystery in terms of its investor influence, in terms of psychology. You know, QE was an asset swap, is you give me your bond, I'll give you the cash, but the cash that the bank took just went back to the Fed. So not all of that money made it out into the real world.
IOER.
In the economy and in markets. So a lot of the QE was psychological. Now, there's plenty that's still filtered out there. I mean, can't discount the effect that QE in Europe and Japan had when they suppressed rates to nothing and it forced people to take a lot of risk. So on the reverse side, the monetary base is shrinking. The level of reserves is shrinking. The inflation tinder, which is essentially what QE was, is getting pulled back. And it combined with the ECB that's no longer expanding their balance sheet and the Bank of Japan, which has basically cut QE in half and is actually stepping away from inflation targeting of 2%, this Fed put that was at the money is now far out of the money. So it's harder to quantify the direct impact of QE. It's easier to quantify more of the psychological impact as opposed to rates going up, rates going down is much easier to quantify in terms of the cost of capital.
In some of our past episodes, we've discussed the role of these extraordinary monetary measures on liquidity in emerging markets and also in corporate bond market. Are those two areas in particular, and I also will mention that heading into Christmas, the financials got hammered, and they were down, I think, 25% by the end of December off their highs, and 18%, I think, in 3 weeks' time. It was, in general, I think this is the second worst December we've had. Are there certain areas in the market that you and investors generally are looking at more and the media perhaps is paying more attention to than others as canaries in the coal mine?
Well, the first canary that really popped was the splintering of the FANG trade. I mean, that was the driver.
You're right. That's
of,
true.
Of,
when was that?
Of the economy.
In the summer. When did that begin?
Well, it sort of started with Facebook.
Yeah.
And then you had Netflix that reported disappointing subscriber numbers in the beginning of the year. That's really when it started to separate.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Amazon disappointed with their last earnings release. Google also disappointed with their last earnings release. So Apple, of course, had its own problems. Many months ago, I said the FANG trade is dead in terms of those stocks trading as one group, and that you're going to have to analyze each of them on their own with their own individual circumstances. Those are the leader of the markets.
It does seem kind of odd that Amazon would be grouped up with Facebook, doesn't it? What do they have in common?
Well, exactly. It was fast growing and market caps that were
so interesting,
somewhat aligned in terms of size. But at the peak, FANG plus Microsoft made up 17% of the S&P 500. So that was key. But then you got to September and you started to splinter the FANG trade. Overseas markets had a rough year up to that point where certain markets went into bear markets, and then you started to get to the Russell 2000, and then it spread to everywhere else. Problem with the banks is the yield curve is inverting on the short end, and banks are still very economically sensitive. If rates are going up and there's less demand for loans, at the end of the day, that's what banks do. They make loans.
But also, isn't that also, though, good for banks in another way because it helps them make more money on the carry?
Right. But if my loan growth is slowing, well, where am I going to get growth?
Also, the question is, has that traditional lending model broken down? What has been the change in how banks generate revenue today versus, let's say, 30 years ago?
Well, there's still massive loan books to households through mortgages. Well, housing has slowed. Housing is in a recession.
Right.
What's that do to your mortgage book? Well, Wells Fargo, in particular, huge mortgage lender. Credit cards. C&I loans. I mean, banks still reliant on loans, maybe not to the same extent because we have a more developed capital markets on the corporate side, but banks are still in the business of lending.
You mentioned Apple before. I want to talk about Apple. It's something that I don't think we've ever discussed Apple on the program, and I'm really interested in having a conversation about it with its recent miss. I think that's a big deal, and it'll open up the conversation for a number of things. But before we get off of the Fed, I want to mention Steve Mnuchin's press release from the Treasury and stuff like that happened in December. That was so bizarre. I couldn't remember something like that in recent memory of something that was so out of left field. The Trump administration, of course, has done this stuff all the time, but it never felt so personal. It never felt like it was, you know, in the domain of financial markets. Is there a consensus ultimately about what that was about? Well, that's just a dumb thing that he did, or did it mean something? Are we supposed to draw something out of that?
I think it reflected a level of cluelessness. You know, the liquidity of the banking system is fighting the last war. I think we've pretty much addressed that after the 08 crisis. Just because markets go down, that doesn't mean it's, you know, an economic calamity. So I really believe that it was a level of cluelessness.
Did he just
want
to get
part.
In front of the camera? Did he just want some attention?
I don't know. What I do know is that the administration was panicking in December for the decline in the markets, and they were doing everything they could to literally get involved and try to stop the decline in the stock market.
Do you think Trump called Steve Mnuchin on the phone?
Well, look what followed. The Saturday before New Year's, Trump tweets, talks are going great with China.
Yeah.
They did everything they could to stem the decline in the stock market. So you live by the stock market, you die by the stock market if you're a president that is so dependent on it. But also, we're an asset price dependent economy that goes back to Greenspan. And that the last two recessions were driven by declines in asset prices, whereas most economic cycles before that were typically inventory cycles.
I'm looking for this tweet that you sent out, Peter, recently. It was a Wall Street Journal article. I can't find it now, but it had to do with wealth. Here it is. Among the growing risks, investors are assessing their own fear, from the Wall Street Journal. I think the point had to do with the nominal value of assets, of wealth, basically, to GDP, one of its highest points since when? Since the 1920s?
Well, ever. Well, if you look at net worth as a percent of disposable income.
Remarkable.
We're at 700%. We're far above where we were in 07 and even further above where we were in 2000. So that explains the difference between what the value of people's assets are, whether it's their house, their savings, their stock portfolios, versus actual disposable income, which is what an economy generates. And now that article talked about net worth relative to GDP, but it's still the same concept.
Right, exactly, 100%. Yeah, and this has this phenomenal chart. In 1980, the ratio of household financial assets to nominal GDP was around 2.25%. Today, it's above 4.25. It's like 4.4. Remarkable. That's something we've talked about on the show, which is the difference between wealth and income and the huge wealth gap. And basically, I think what stuck out to me about that article is how important are the health of financial markets, the nominal value of assets, more important today than they used to be? And can a decline in financial markets spark a recession? Is the economy more sensitive to what happens in financial markets today than it would have been, let's say, 20 years ago?
More than ever before.
More than like 1987, where markets collapsed, went down 22%, and the economy continued to grow.
Exactly. And because that net worth number is so large relative to the actual economy.
Right.
And the Fed knows this. That's why Bernanke wrote an editorial in the Washington Post explaining why he's doing QE, because he talked about the wealth effect and lifting markets and how that would spur consumer spending. Well, what did they think was going to happen when we saw the reverse and we saw QT instead of QE? You were going to get a reset on valuations. So there's a big difference in the value of the S&P 500 when you pay 17 or 18 times earnings versus when you pay 14 or 15 times.
Mm.
Without any change in earnings, just that multiple rethink leads to lower prices. So right now, 2018, I would really define mostly as a PE multiple rethink. The issue facing 2019 is you're going to potentially combine that PE multiple rethink lower with global growth that's slowing that could then lead to the E part of the PE that will also go lower too. So a lower PE on a lower earnings number leads to a lower stock market.
The rethink, you're saying that investors will demand a lower price-to-earnings ratio in order to be invested.
Exactly, and what they're willing to pay.
Doesn't that go back to my point about the shift in investor sentiment that doesn't correspond to any objective reality? It just seems to be a change in the narrative?
Well, a lot of it is trading off what's the Fed doing.
Yeah.
Fed's cutting, that's good. Fed's hiking, that's bad. And when the
that's
Fed's easy, let's pay a higher PE multiple. When the Fed's tightening, let's have a lower PE multiple. Sometimes it's as simple as that in terms of investor mentality.
I wasn't sure if we were still in that dynamic. I wonder if it's still as strong as it was. I was actually thinking before you came in, when we were talking about forward guidance, I don't know if you're familiar with these trigger warnings in schools and stuff like that. We've covered them on the show. We had Jonathan Haidt on the show. And maybe markets need trigger warnings now. Everyone's gotten so sensitive. Financial markets, just they need more than...
It's amazing how much a decline in markets now relative to the past affects psychology. Whether it's someone looking for an apartment in New York City where the financial market presence is obviously pretty large because of the dependency economically, to people see just moves in interest rates, moves in the mortgage rates. Mortgage rates go from 4.5% to 5%, and you see a collapse in refis.
Well, we have a tremendous amount of debt.
Well, that gets to the problem.
Isn't that the bottom line?
Small changes in interest rates have a pronounced effect because you have big dollars of debt where even small changes in interest rates means big changes on a dollar basis in interest expense and the cost of funding.
That's a huge problem for China, too. We're going to get into that when we get into Apple. Before we get to Apple, one more thing I wanted to mention or I wanted to ask you about, which is the government shutdown. Generally speaking, financial markets, and this goes back to the point about Mnuchin's tweet sort of riling everybody up, uncharacteristically, the financial markets have been largely indifferent to the Trump administration's actions. If anything, they've taken positively to the change in regulatory rhetoric and taxes, right? But now, when this episode airs, if the government is still shut down, that'll make it the longest on record, I believe. That'll beat the 1995 Congress, the Newt Gingrich Congress. How is market sentiment react to the shutdown this time around? It seems like this time it feels different.
Well, it feels different because of the potential of the length of it. But markets are desensitized to these government shutdowns because I like to say that you have death and taxes as a certainty. But you also have the certainty if the government shuts down, it's going to soon reopen.
That's a good one.
So the pressure now is getting really extreme. to me, what tipped it over is hearing the stories about TSA employees at the airports that are calling in sick.
Or prison guards. Vice did a story on prison guards.
Now we're at a point where I have to believe that this is going to end rather soon. So to me, it's more of just an annoyance, a nuisance, good for the politicians and nightmare for everybody else in terms of psychology, but not really having much of an economic impact at all.
So what happened with Apple? Fill our investors in on the news that moved markets on Apple's stock price. I think it dropped by 10% the day after Tim Cook made some comments and they released a 1,400-page letter revising their revenue estimates down because of lower-than-expected iPhone sales, and they blamed primarily on China and on the Chinese-U.S. trade war. Give us some context for this.
Well, the context is the smartphone market is basically flatlining. It's completely saturated.
That's been going on for a while
itself.
Now. That's
and
right.
In fact,
I've got actually a chart right here from 2013. When was it? It began like around 2015, 2016, mm-hmm. It started to flatline?
And Apple smartphones unit volumes have flatlined for the last couple of years. They've been able to offset that by these price increases.
Right.
Well, then now they've reached a point where price increases, people are saying, well, why do I need to buy an iPhone? Particularly when you're in China and all you need is access to WeChat, owned by Tencent, and you don't need to get into the Apple ecosystem. You want to get into the WeChat system, and you can get that from any phone, an Android or an Apple.
That's all in the cloud?
Well, WeChat is basically their messaging service. There's their payment system. It's a lot of different things in one that's what the Chinese want. So Apple's losing market share, not because the Chinese consumer and the Chinese economy is slowing, which it clearly is, but they've priced themselves out of the market, and that's their problem. In addition to having the biggest contributor to their profits, the smartphone, being a completely saturated market that's no longer growing.
So how much of Apple's problems are Apple-specific, and how much of this is, do you think, related to the trade war? Let's take the Apple-specific headwinds first. I did a little research before you came into the studio today when I was preparing for this episode, because I was a huge fan of Apple for a very long time. As a customer, I'm really disappointed with their products for years now. One of the things that I noticed very early on after Steve Jobs passed away was that they began to complicate the interface. You know, this is an anecdotal complaint here. I don't know if you've noticed it. I don't know if you're an Apple user, you're a Samsung user.
I have a Droid, but my whole family's got Apple.
Yeah, so it used to be very simple. I mean, ever since Tim Cook took over, it's hard, even just navigating the back end. Features show up, I never use them, I don't know what they are. So the company has changed, right? It's not the same company as it was. Also, the number of employees, I have this here somewhere. When Apple, I think when they launched the iPhone, here it is, they had 17,787 employees. Today they have 132,000. And that's doubled since 2012. So this is a much different company. I was struck, went and found the interview, there was this interview by Steve Jobs. It was part of the Lost Interview series, I think, where he's talking about, I think, Microsoft and IBM. He certainly mentioned IBM by name, if I remember correctly. But he made the point about why large companies struggle to innovate. And he said that, you know, when a company becomes big, they begin to focus on process. They look at how successful they were early on, and they say there must have been something magic in the process. And so they focus on process. They promote people who are great at process, and they don't have people that are great at content, great at the technology, the innovation at the top. And I feel like that was the first thought I had when Steve handed the reins over to Tim Cook. Tim Cook's a process guy. He's not a content guy. He doesn't have that magic. So it's a very different company, and they've done very well. But I wonder, first of all, I guess this is super long-winded, Peter. One thought is, how do investors look at Apple? Do they look at Apple, because we used to look at Apple as Steve's company. In many ways, Tesla, I think, is sort of the watered-down version of Apple in terms of how investors look at it today. They give a lot of credit to Elon, and they're not really so worried about the numbers. How are investors judging Apple today based on the past, and what are the challenges that the company has as you see it?
Well, based on the valuation after the earnings announcement, they're obviously skeptical of what that next new thing is to drive growth. It's really hard to create a product, a mass market product, that was as successful as the iPhone. It's probably the great, most successful consumer product ever invented in terms of its scale and size and revenue. Mm. And before that, they hit it with the iPod.
Yeah. And so, iTunes.
Right, but iTunes was sort of like an accessory to iPod. So to create the iPod, the iPad, the iPhone, and sort of strike it three times.
The Mac, too.
Yeah, but Mac's much smaller market share. But they didn't create the iPad in terms of the technology, but they globalized the concept of something that's not a notepad.
Mm-hmm. And then they went and stuck a stylus on it, by the way. I mean, all these things, my point.
But I'm saying it's hard to do this once, and they did it three times.
Did the watch totally bomb?
I mean, I think the watch is fine, but it's not as distinctive, and there's a lot of competition to that iWatch. And it's just not going to be the same kind of product. So I understand that Tim Cook is certainly not Steve Jobs, and people can accuse them of not having the same sort of innovation pipeline that they had. But again, it's really, really hard to create a successful mass market product on the scale that they were able to achieve with the iPod, iPad, and iPhone.
I mean, there are people that haven't, you know, complained about their watch to me, but no one's told me anything enthusiastic about it. But I think what's interesting, to go back to this thing about process, whereas Steve Jobs was focused on products and innovation, Apple has, I think, just tried to milk the products they already have. Made the point about the increasing the prices on their phones. They've really relied on the fact that they're a luxury brand. And also this new thing, which I think is smart, around security. But I don't know if people believe that. I mean, they had some positive news stories around the San Bernardino and things like this, like, you know, fighting the government to protect the rights of their users. But I don't know how much people believe that actually their stuff is safe on Apple, and that's like a product differentiator. I don't know. I mean, I don't see kind of how the company can justify its stock price just if they're relying on innovation. I don't see
any... Well, they're trying to really scale the services side. They're trying to say, okay, you're a user of my product.
Right.
And I'm going to then try to sell you as much as I can as you access that product, whether it's the store, it's music, it's going to be movies, and they just had announced a deal with Samsung on the TV. So that's what they're trying to do, but that's not the same sort of growth story as they had in the past. I mean, the Apple growth story we saw the last 20 years is over. You can't replicate that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they won't be successful in other ways, but that 20-year run is over and unlikely to be replicated again.
It's kind of like shale oil to renewables. You know, you're fracking. You're finding a way to get more of the existing technology out of the existing technology, but you're not innovating. And you could do that successfully for a very long time. And I'm no expert on it, but let's take the second side of this, which is the China story, right? China is something we've covered for a while, and it is a web of confusion, its economy, in so many different ways. How much of this story do you think markets are interpreting as being China-specific and trade-specific?
China being the second biggest economy, of course, everything they do matters for the rest of us. And there's clear evidence of dramatic slowing in China. I don't think that's in doubt. The question is to what degree does it further slow? How does it infect its trading partners? And what can the Chinese do, if anything, to try to control the slowdown? Now, their economy has been slowing for the last 5 years. This is not new. But they know they've reached a point where the excessive credit growth that was driving that growth needed to slow. We're now seeing them trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again to some extent to try to stem the slowdown in the economy. But it's slowing. It will continue to slow. And everyone should be prepared for the repercussions to the rest of the world. That being said, longer term, I'm still very bullish on China. You know, one thing that we've done that will backfire on us with respect to these tariffs is China realizes they can't depend on us anymore. Mm. And they're going to depend on not only their own ingenuity in creating their own industrial powerhouses, but they're going to trade more with their own region. They're going to trade more with the Europeans. And we've awoken a giant that, well, was already awake, if you see what China's created over the last 20 years. So they're going to have some short-term problems, no question, but China is going to be a major competitor for the next 20 years, and their economy again is slowing, and it's going to have repercussions everywhere. to me, they're a giant, and it's still going to be a very exciting story longer term.
Do you hold out any hope for a resolution in the next 2 years?
Well, I think we'll get a short-term cosmetic resolution within the next month. Mm. So both sides are pressured to do something. Mm. I said months ago that there was a third player at the negotiating table, and that was the market. And the Trump administration saw what happened in the markets in the fourth quarter, and the market was basically at that table telling Trump and Lighthizer and his advisors, you better make a deal because look how we're going to react if you don't. And China has their own legitimate economic weakness that they're dealing with. And they know that if they want to maintain these supply chains that have been created over the last 20 years, they need to come to a deal because they don't want to see their manufacturing base all of a sudden go to Vietnam and Bangladesh.
Mm. It's an interesting story and development, this trade war. And I think one of the reasons for that is I don't know, no one knows just how impaired China's economy is as a result of this and how asymmetric that relationship is between how much it hurts them versus us.
But I hear that argument a lot. We can continue because China's going to get hurt more than we are. Tell that to the American farmer who just lost their biggest customer and who is, after selling 30 million tons of soybeans, is now back but buying 3 to 4 million. Tell that to the average small business that is reliant on product from China that they can't get anywhere else that is an input to their finished product. So this idea that, oh, China is going to get hurt more than us and therefore it's okay. To me, the tool of tariffs in addressing our trade issues with China, particularly on the theft of U.S. technology, was a really stupid idea. And we're going to look back on this and saying, what the F were they thinking?
Well, we both know David Kotak, and when Dave was on the show, he talked about, you know, how he has the investor conference up in Maine, and he was speaking with some lobster suppliers up there who've been totally crushed as a result of the tariffs. But I do think that there's a big part of the country that's looking for a fight. They want a fight with China, and they want a fight, generally speaking. And there is a lot to be, I think, upset about. I've had actually a listener who has, I think, has been constructively critical about my view around the extent to which the Chinese government has taken advantage of U.S. companies with respect to IP and such. So I want to grant that point, but I think there is some truth to that. And I think the problem has been...
Oh, there is. My issue is how do you address it?
Yeah, exactly. The question being, like, is there a strategy behind it? It doesn't seem to be a strategy to take advantage of the beer muscles, you know what I mean? Of the bold rhetoric. So... You know, I was going to say, speaking of beer muscles, but I don't know that beer muscles relate to Tesla. But I want to talk to you about Tesla a little bit, because Tesla for me has been like the bellwether stock for this bull market. I think it has benefited from the cheap availability of capital. It has, I think, imbibed the euphoria around Silicon Valley and technology, even though it's not a tech company, and a lot of the hopes and aspirations of investors. And it's been remarkably resilient. It has been so freaking resilient in the face of SEC regulations, generally really crazy number of executive departures. I mean, lots of what could be just devastating news. What do you think accounts for the resilience of that stock price?
I think it's Elon Musk. I think if it was anybody else.
What is it about Elon Musk? Larry Ellison was out today, yesterday. I saw a clip on Bloomberg. I don't know if you saw it. You probably, there's too much stuff for you to see. But he was speaking at some conference, and you know how he is now on the board, and he's, I think, over, he has over $1 billion worth of stock in Tesla.
Yeah,
he's the second biggest investor. And he was talking about, you know, he was sort of poo-pooing Tesla's critics, but he never really made any substantive statements. You know, he made a point about, like, you know, people are being negative on Tesla because of the numbers, but I don't think people are being negative on Tesla because of the numbers. I think they're being negative on Tesla. Well, some of them might be, but I haven't seen a substantive path towards profitability. Have you?
Well, there are people that know this story a lot better than I do. All I know is, at least with the Model 3, is they need to get a certain number of dollars per car of north of $40,000 in order to make any money doing this. And I think it still remains to be seen whether they can make this a viable business going forward.
But doesn't your bullshit detector go off when you listen to Steve Jobs, Freudian slip. Yeah, you know, it could have been Steve Jobs, but Steve Jobs delivered. Elon Musk, I mean... My bullshit detector goes through the roof.
In the history of markets, there are always story stocks. Some actually work out and many do not. I think the question with Tesla is they've gotten to this point and putting aside Musk, they have a very high market cap. They have a lot of debt. They have high-priced cars. And are they going to be able to survive
the onslaught of competition?
The onslaught of competition and the next downturn where not everybody can pay 45 to 50 grand if financing is not as easy as it once was. And there are more expensive models. How are people going to respond to that? And also then losing the tax credit.
The tax credit.
On the part of buyers who use that as an incentive to buy the car. So hope, faith, friendly capital markets, a cool technology, a charismatic CEO. So that gets you to here. Now the true test comes is how do you get from here to there, there being sustainable profitability that sort of grows into its valuation.
I should say this too. I've had some listeners, one also who recently subscribed to our subscription service, who have been critical of my criticisms of Tesla. You know, I love the car. I think it's amazing. I've driven a Tesla. It's one of the most amazing cars I've ever driven. Like I said, it's just my bullshit detector goes off with this company. And you made the other point about financing. It brings us back to the corporate bond market and bank regulations. A lot of this has changed. I mean, these companies have relied heavily on the bond market and Tesla in particular. You said storage stocks. You know, before we conclude our interview, I want to talk about these marijuana stocks. I know you have some affiliation with one company. You're on the board of a particular company. You can tell us about whatever you can tell us. I don't know. But I find this fascinating because marijuana stocks for me are in the same bundle. It's these three stocks. It's marijuana stocks, crypto, and Tesla. These three fall in the same area because they're so, I think, driven by sort of the story, right? What is going on with marijuana stocks and what do you see for them in 2019?
Well, let's look at the actual business itself, and then we'll get to the stocks. I don't think there's any denying the explosion of the industry. And that's because what was behind the scenes is now legitimate in the states that have legalized it. So we know that there's a huge demand for medicinal and recreational marijuana. Well, if that's the case, well, you're going to have the companies that are going to service that huge demand. The industry is exploding in size. So then you throw in obviously publicly traded companies, mostly in Canada, that are trying to now take advantage on the growth side, the dispensary side, the service side. And yes, valuations have disconnected, but they disconnected in the late 1990s as well when it came to the internet. There wasn't anybody questioning the internet and the technology and whether it was going to explode in size and breadth. It was a question of, can these companies make money servicing that industry and survive? So a lot of the companies today are servicing a wildly fast-growing industry where there's legitimate demand, and a lot of these are legitimate businesses, but they have valuations that are on hope in terms of how big these companies can get. But I don't think there's any question, anybody doubting the legitimacy and the actual growth of the industry.
Of the market. I was at Robinhood this year, and one of the best presentations was of a big bear, not on the industry itself, not on the market, but some of these companies, like Constellation Brands, and I don't remember the other names. There were three in particular that he had marked as giant shorts.
Well, Constellation paid a big dollar number to get a piece of, I think it was Tilray.
Tilray was another one. When did that deal happen?
Or was it Canopy Growth? It was either Canopy Growth.
It was
or
those
Tilray,
three, I think, that he mentioned. Canopy Growth, but Constellation, and Tilray.
Right.
And he made another point about Canada being a really shitty place to grow marijuana because it doesn't have much sunlight and it's Canada.
Yeah. So a lot of those are warehouses opposed to greenhouses. But, you know, the issue that those companies face, and that's where they're trying to differentiate themselves, is at the end of the day, it's a commodity product making cannabis, where the value of that product, that crop, so to speak, is going to go down. Just as any commodity product.
As you go high.
Right. Well, that's why they're trying to differentiate, create brands and specific medical strains and trying to be more of a value-added producer rather than just another commodity producer where only the lowest cost producer wins.
Where are we now in the United States in terms of legalization? So Colorado, California.
Well, you have 30 states that have it.
Fully legalized?
That either have both or one of the, or medicinal.
Which ones have full legalization? Like you can smoke it
on
the street?
There's Washington, there's Nevada, there's
Colorado,
Oregon,
right?
Obviously Colorado, Massachusetts. So we're
Massachusetts,
adding,
really? When did that happen?
Yeah, just within the last couple of years. So we're adding more of these every election. New Jersey's on their path to legalizing recreational. New York is looking to legalize recreational. So It's headed in the direction of all states at some point.
So does that mean we get like coffee houses like in Amsterdam? Are we going to have like, if New York legalizes, I mean, is that, they'll need licenses, but that's a pretty remarkable, I mean, this is, again, this is not related to any market question.
Every state will have its own rules, but right now it's at the dispensary level where you need ID to get into a dispensary and you have to be 21 in order to purchase.
So two more questions. Well, maybe more than two questions, but two more sort of topics. One has to do with what I think is a huge phenomenon or force that's sort of, I think, intractable that no one's discussing, which is the Trump phenomenon is a right-wing populist event. And I think that we can be confident, not just based off what we're already seeing with this new crop of Democrats coming into the White House, but given something we discussed before, which is value of assets to nominal GDP, basically the wealth gap, we can expect to see, it would be more than reasonable to expect to see a left-wing populist to come into the White House at some point. Maybe that'll be 2020. And based on Cortez, a recent interview she gave on 60 Minutes, she mentioned raising taxes to maybe 60, 70%. Forget numbers and things like that. I think just generally speaking, no one seems to be discussing the impact of tighter regulations and higher taxes that are sure as shit coming, let's say, in a few years, if the Democrats take over the White House.
Right. I don't think markets are going to think about that until 2020. They're not going to really start pricing that in now because we don't know how this all plays out. We don't know how the economy is going to be or who the Democrats decide to run against Trump. I do want to bring this back to the Fed and central banks inflating asset prices relative to disposable income. So in this discussion of inequality and the haves and the have-nots and the rise of populism generally, at least on the left, is going to be, you know, look how much they make and look how much these others don't, and let's take from them and give to others. Well, you've had our central bank that has helped to inflate of assets of things that people own, but not everybody owns those assets.
Right.
And so, but I think the
market, the problem isn't solved by raising taxes or lowering interest rates when the issue is the wealth disparity. The wealth transfer. The real problem is that there is a huge discrepancy in wealth that didn't exist 30 years ago.
Right. And again, central banks have inflated the stock market. And who owns stocks? It's
people
mostly
that can afford to do it.
Exactly. So, well, that's what happens when you inflate the asset of what people own when many others don't own it.
What I meant was not so much that, you know, I expect CNBC or Bloomberg to be covering this as some like immediate issue, but the way that the media covers politics is really the social dynamics of it. The social issues are the really big thing, right?
Because that's what sells. That's emotional. It sounds good. But, you know, socialism to people, it sounds good. You know, everyone gets stuff for free and medical care and education, and this is great. But then they should go to Venezuela and see how that all works out.
No, I hear you, but I'm just saying, I guess this is what I mean. I think the way that this sort of blue wave is being covered, it's covering like the Me Too movement, it's covering social issues. It's not covering this thing about wealth, which I think is going to be the biggest story in terms of the difference between Democrats and Republicans to the left and the right. I think it's going to be the difference, and I think the Republicans are eventually going to come on board in the same direction as the Democrats, because I just think the wealth disparity is so great that everyone's going to demand to do something about it.
Well, it'll matter when the economy turns down.
Oh, for sure.
When you get a recession, that's when things come to the surface. Not until then will you see it to the same extent.
So speaking of that, my last question really is a practical one, which is, do you think, at least in the interim, that stocks are oversold at these levels, that the declines we saw in December offered some really good opportunities to pick up certain equities? And if so, do you have any sort of, and this is not financial advice, I have no, this is not.
Well, in the short term, no question. I mean, people understand that if you have cash to buy stocks, a bear market is a good time to buy stocks. You want to buy stocks in a bear market because that means those prices have been marked down.
But are we in a bear market?
And valuations are attractive. I believe most likely we are. And that we did get dramatically oversold. The market got what it wanted in terms of the Fed backing off and probably a China deal. But I still think we are in the midst of one. I still think now we're going to start to see the economic repercussions of the global slowdown, and that earnings have topped out and margins have topped out, and that for those with short-term time horizons who don't have much cash, I recommend raising cash. For those that have long-term time horizons that have a lot of cash, well, they should welcome declines because you want to buy stocks at cheaper valuations, which I think the market will present itself. I know people like to look at the price-to-earnings ratio and say, okay, we're trading 17, 18 times and it's not too far out of whack. On a price-to-sales basis, which is another statistic I like to look at because it's less manipulated than earnings, got to where it was in 2000 this year. So we were as overvalued on that statistic as we were in 2000. Hmm. That's not a good time to be buying stocks if you need cash over the next couple of years. So yes, I do think it's more likely than not we're in a bear market, and this is going to take time to play itself out.
Peter, I want to thank you for coming on the program also on such short notice. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And that was my episode with Peter Bukvar. I want to thank Peter for being on my program. Today's episode of Hidden Forces was recorded at Edge Studio in New York City. For more information about this week's episode, or if you want easy access to related programming, visit our website at hiddenforces.io and subscribe to our free email list. If you want access to overtime segments, episode transcripts, and show rundowns full of links and detailed information related to each and every episode, check out our premium subscription available through the Hidden Forces website or through our Patreon page. Today's episode was produced by me and edited by Stylianos Nicolaou. For more episodes, you can check out our website at hiddenforces.io. Join the conversation at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Hidden Forces Pod, or send me an email at dk@hiddenforces.io. As always, thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.